to come up and introduce our speaker. Come on.
I'm an addict named Lorraine. That's truly an honor to introduce one of my dearest friends in the program. I've known Janice, will have 20 years next month. And I've known her most of her recovery. She's one of my closest friends. And what I can tell you about Janice is she loves NA. She does a ton of service. She has a home group that's, if you're ever in Hollywood, Florida on a Friday night, come to the Indian Reservation. It's called No Reservations. And there's always over 100 people there, and she does a lot of service in that group. It's her home group. And she travels all over. She gives people rides everywhere. She travels all over the state of Florida to speak. She travels all over the country to speak. And they say a grateful addict will never use, and I know Janice will never use, because she's one of the most grateful people that I know. She's one of the most humblest people I know. She's a very compassionate and generous person. And when you hear her story from when she was a little girl and the trials and tribulations that she has been through to get her where she is today, it's an absolute miracle. And I know you're all going to fall in love with her, just like we have fallen in love with her in Florida and everywhere else that she speaks. I love you. Come up here.
Hello everybody, my name is Janice, and I am a grateful recovering addict. Yes. And here we are. I want to thank first God for bringing us here together tonight, and to the committee for asking me to come out here and share with people that I love, people like me, people that saved my life. And when I first came and I heard people say these words, it's an honor and a privilege. I didn't get it, you know, like, you know, I was new, I didn't want to be here, didn't know what was going on, and I had no idea the power behind that, you know, the meaning behind it's an honor and a privilege. And it really is. I understand it today because my life today is so different than what it was when I walked in here almost 20 years ago. Now, if you would have told me, you know, like a lot of people say, if you would have told me I would be like this card-carrying, you know, in love with the program kind of person, I would have thought you were crazy, because I came to a facility that brought me to meetings in the white van or the white bus, one or the other. And I had come to that facility straight from the Department of Corrections. It was my third time back inside, and there was every reason for the parole commission to revoke me and put me back in for a number of years. But through what I know now, through the grace of my higher power, instead of going back in, they decided, my lawyer said to the commission, and I used to choke up every time I'd say this in the past, he said, Janice is a good person with a disease that she's never been treated for, and I have every belief that if she gets help, she'll be a productive member of society. And I used to choke up because, you know, it was absolutely prophetic. It was true. But, you know, I was a non-treated addict at the time, and I said, yeah, that's right, tell him. I'm thinking, yeah, that sounds good. Get me out of this, you know. But the gift and the grace is that it was the right, you know, I got to the place and they took me to meetings. And I went to a meeting, I went to these meetings over and over. They take you every day. And I got a white key tag, I think the next night I was there at a meeting called Just Listen in North Miami. And that's pretty much how my journey began. I started to listen. Because I was from a background of mostly prison, I went to prison the first time when I was 17 years old. I got out at 24. I did 7 years on a life sentence. Back then, you could parole on a life sentence. Now, that doesn't happen. I got out at 24. I went back at 26, and I didn't get out till I was 42. I got out at 42, and I was out 3 years, and I used, and I went back. And that's when that happened, that I got help instead of time. And so when I walked into the rooms, I was 46, and I've been in prison 23 years altogether, so half my life. I'm institutionalized, severely institutionalized. And I'm in an institution again, different one, but I'm in an institution again. And I have to go to these meetings. I have to do what they say in this program. That's all I wanted to do, everything right so I could get out. You know, when am I getting out of here? How long I got to be here? Like I was doing time, you know? And what, you know, everything I'm going to share is what I learned, you know, on my own. I didn't know much of anything. Because if I knew so much, why would I have been locked up half my life? And, you know, but you couldn't tell me that at the time. I'm a person that thought I was very smart. If I didn't know it, I will figure it out, and I'll figure out how to get over. You know, I was one of them kind of people. So I get here, and they tell me, you know, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. You know, that's what I remember. And I also remember my journey began with the readings, the ones we just heard. These people just were, you know, kind enough to come up here and read. It began with that because I'm an ex-convict. I'm listening because I got to figure out what I got to say and how I got to act and everything for them to let me out. So I'm listening, and I listened so hard that, you know, like it started to clear up the fog in my head because it was very simple. You know, who is an addict? And, you know, why are we here? It all started to make sense. And one of the readings really caught my ear was, we wanted something different and thought we found it in drugs. Because I was a drug addict. I loved drugs. So drugs was in my history, which is why the parole commission sent me to this place. And I liked to get high. I started getting high like at the age of 12. But when I heard that, we wanted something different and thought we found it in drugs. And another thing they talk about here, if you haven't heard it, is the onion, peeling the onion, you know, like, recovery is a journey. It's been a journey for me, you know, like next month I'm going to have 20 years. And it's amazing. I'm going to be 66 this month. It's baffling. It's baffling. I'm like, what happened? You know, I had a year, I was new, I was scared, I didn't know what to do, and now almost 20 years, and we talk about change. The gentleman last night, Jim, right, said it's about change. You know, they told me the person who walked in here, if it's the same person who walked in here, will use again. Okay, so we're talking about change. So when I read that line, when I heard that, I'm saying, wanted something different, thought we found it in drugs. I said, well, what did I want to be different? You know, I started to take that first little flaky piece off the onion, you know, not even the layer, just the little flaky cover. I just kind of took that off, and I said, what did I want to be different? And I realized it was everything. I wanted to look different, I wanted to act different, I wanted to feel different, I wanted to be different. I didn't like me. There was nothing about me that was okay, which is why probably around 12, I picked up my first substance and was off to the races, you know, like more, anything, can't stop, you know, ways and means, everything that we read, that we hear. From 12 years old, it was like because I had to have something in order to feel okay. Or maybe not even okay, but not just to feel how I felt. And that took time to figure out what it is I was trying not to feel. Because, you know, I didn't step in here with the language of NA. You know, I stepped in here with the language of mostly prison, you know. And when I got to this place, like I said, I just want to say this. I was 46 years old, had been locked up a total of 23 years. But when I walked in there, you couldn't tell me. They were going to see how smart I was. They were going to, like, throw me out of here in a couple of weeks. They're going to see I don't need it, you know. And I always say that because that was a screenshot of my disease. You know, I think I'm so smart. But, you know, I hadn't been able to live life in any kind of way for my whole life, practically. And we talk about surrender. You know, it took me a couple months there in that place, going to meetings, hearing the message, getting a sponsor. I had a sponsor who actually used to come and take me on paths from the center and work steps with me. You know, I had angels in my life on this journey. I still do. And I'm very open to that, you know. Like, I thought, as growing up, I thought everything was so chaotic and random and miserable and negative, and, you know, and as my journey has progressed in this spiritual, not religious program, things have come to be more clear, you know. And what I mean by that is, you know, as humans, we developed like out of a cell, right? A cell divided and divided again, and evolution. We evolved. We evolved. We didn't all come out looking like this at one time. You know, it was a process. It was a journey. So I've come to believe that we have a human physical evolution. Why can't we have a spiritual evolution? And that journey for me has come through the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the sushi, you know, everything. The meeting after the meeting before the meeting, the coffee commitment, the, you know, all of it. Not one thing would I change of this process, because I stand here today free. Free. Free like, what's that commercial? Free, 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 free. Have you seen that? So free, and not just the bars and the cells and the razor wire, and, you know, not just that, but free in my heart, free in my spirit. You know, the feeling of being comfortable in my own skin. And I never felt like that for so long. I'm almost choking up. I never felt like that for so long, that if you're sitting here today and this isn't comfortable for you, and you feel like this, if you don't have hope, or if you feel a little hope, or if you've been to rehab 50 times or 10 times or to detox, and, you know, if you have that hopeless feeling or thoughts, I mean, I'm here for you. I'm here for you. Because I didn't have any of it, you know. I just, at the age of 12 or 13, I had severe suicidal tendency thoughts. You know, I've been to outside help a lot, so, you know, ideation. I had suicidal ideation at a young age. A lot of outside help, gotta tell you. And, you know, and that was like, for me, always a thought of, there's a way out. There's a way out. I'll just kill myself. Life is not worth living. Everything is miserable. I can't. And, you know, as life would, you know, as destiny, I could say, have it. And I'm using now, because I'm picked up at 12, and I'm, you know, I was one of them addicts, you know, if it's not sniffing gasoline, glue, spot remover, lighter fluid, or, you know, stealing liquor and smoking joints, and then I got on the LSD stuff, and, you know, it was anything and everything. I didn't care. I didn't want to feel normal. You know, I wanted to be out of my head. So, stay around here long enough, and sometimes you'll hear the words, the drug stopped working, you know. I couldn't get high enough. I couldn't get anything enough to feel any different inside, that black hole that what they call that God-shaped hole in my soul, in my spirit. And I decided to kill myself. I stole a gun. I was 15 years old by then, and I had gotten kicked out of school. I had already been to jail for stealing a car. You know, I was just what they say, off the chain. I just, behaviors were, you know, getting really crazier. And I thought I was going to save my mom a lot of misery if I just took myself out and saved myself a lot of misery. And stole this gun and was going to do it that night. Again, I was 15 years old. This was in the 70s. And as fate would have it, one of my friends came by and asked me if I'd run him up to the convenience store to get some sodas or something. And I said, all right. I'm thinking, okay, when I get back. And we get to the store, and the store was empty. There was one clerk, and I thought, you know, like addicts, impulsive thought. I said, hey, I don't have to kill myself. I'm going to rob this store, take the money, and run away. You know, like we have these great ideas and they sound really good, right? And the tragedy is that I robbed the store, I panicked, I shot the man and I killed him. And we didn't get arrested for a year later. I was 16, I turned 17 in jail, and I got a life sentence on a second degree murder charge. And again, like I said, I went away for 7 years. And from 17 to 24, I made no progress. Only in the other side, the addiction side. And you know, I'm so grateful to the program of Narcotics Anonymous, and like my friend, one of my friends says, the difference between the person who walked in brand new and to the person I am today is information. A lot of information that you guys gave me and that I was able to process and register and believe and act upon, right? So what I know today, the disease of addiction is not about my drugs. I use drugs, you know, to relieve the symptoms of my addiction. I mean, yeah, to relieve the symptoms, right, of the disease. And because the disease is right here. You know, it's not in my arm, it's not in my, you know, throat, it's in between my ears. The disease of addiction for me is the way I perceive something, you know? Talk about the normal person, you know, they might walk into a room and everybody starts laughing. The normal person might say, what's so funny? The addict's gonna say, why are y'all laughing at me? You know, I would say, what did I do? You know, because I'm self-centered, it's about me. You know, you're looking at me, you're laughing at me, you're talking about me, self, right? The disease of self. So it begins with my perception, and then the way I process it, and then the way I feel about that perception, just like I said, self-centered, and then the way I behave behind the way I feel. You know, from the get-go, the perception is messed up, so everything else is, you know, like an uneven house. It's going to fall. So I learned that here. So where do I have to change? I have to change in between my ears, right? And what I also learned is it's simple, but it might not be real easy, but it's simple. You know, I just followed everything that people shared with me when I got here. Go to meetings, get a sponsor, get a home group, do service, you know, find a God of my understanding, work the steps. It wasn't rocket science. You know, if it was, I'd be still using, right? Or locked up somebody's prison. But you know what I'm saying? It's not hard. And if you're new, I'm here to tell you, I did it really sort of like against my will. I just did it because I wanted to get out of that treatment center. I wanted to move on. I had things to do, like I had a life, you know? So, but like I said, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, because that's what happened. I stuck with it, and the light came on. I love this, the out of the darkness into the light. The light switched on, and a few things happened that I'll share with you. One is, early recovery, I see the steps on the wall, the traditions, right? And I read, and I get to the eighth step, the eighth and the ninth step, about making amends. And instantly, like any addict, without thinking anything through, I got really sad, because I was starting to become open-minded to this. I was starting to become willing. And then I read that, and I said, I started to get sad. I said, this isn't going to work for me. I'm telling a friend, and he said, what do you mean? I said, how am I going to make an amends to someone who isn't here, thinking about the man that I killed? And first of all, he goes, well, first of all, you haven't even worked step one. You know, I put on the brakes here. And then he said, do you want to do some work on it? And my heart and soul said, absolutely not. That sounded terrifying, right? But through the grace of what I believe to be now, you know, my higher power, my mouth said yes. Yes. Because I did know one thing. Somewhere in my soul, I did know that I didn't know anything and that I was going to have to do something. Because look at my life up till now, had that moment of clarity. It hasn't been much of a life. So that was what gave me like a little courage to say yes. And he said, okay, I want you to write a letter. And right away I'm thinking, oh, you know how we like try to think before we hear. I'm thinking, oh, I gotta write a letter and apologize. That was my thought, my first thought. And he said, no, I want you to write a letter to yourself as if it was from the man you killed. And I was like, okay, you know, that was a real mind twist there. But this man's name was Charles Henry Davis. And I know that because when I was arrested, the cops told me his name and how he was just this normal guy, had moved to Florida and had this little job and was just trying to live out the rest of his life in peace. And so I knew his name, and he said, so I said, okay, but it was a simple okay, but it was a tough process because this is like 30-something years later, okay? I'm 46 now. That happened when I was 15. So what happened is it opened the door to my feelings that I had never had. Because going back a little bit, stop that part and go back a little bit with me, you know. My father drank himself to death. My father died from this disease. We grew up around addiction our whole lives, me and my brothers and sisters, my uncles, cousins, everybody. You know, this alcohol and drugs are rampant on the reservation. A lot of people die. A lot of people die in addiction. And growing up, it was like normal, you know. Somebody was always in jail, or somebody was always wilding out crazy, and it was normal. You know, the abnormal was normal. So my dad used to come home and jump on my mom. They'd start this knockdown, drag out, black eye, bloody nose kind of fights. Me and my brothers and sisters are in the corner screaming and crying, stop, daddy, stop, screaming, hollering, crying. You know, we were in terror. We were so scared, you know, and that fear never left me. It was imprinted in my soul, in my spirit, and I started to, you know, not respect my dad. You know, and again, like, the other part of it is that when we were around drunks and, you know, environment that wasn't healthy, I was sexually molested at a very early age, probably like 6 or 7 years old. You know, this all around the same time. And that really put a hole in my heart, put a hole in my spirit, you know. And We talk about low self-esteem, but that took me to a level of really no self-esteem. I had no value on things. That's why by the time I was 12, I was really ready to die. You know, I had no self-worth. So by the time I'm 15 years old, I had learned to not feel. I had learned to block out my feelings. I needed to go away in my head in order to survive certain things. So I was able to go away in my head in order to steal and, you know, and be crazy and hurt my mom and not care and just, you know, all the things that addiction brings you to. And, so by the time I was, you know, that age, I didn't feel it. I took this man's life and I had no feeling about it. In prison, I used to say, yeah, I robbed this store and shot this guy. He died and I got a life sentence. You know, I could talk about it up here, but it never went. I never felt it. I never took responsibility for it. So the day that I sat down to write this letter, I couldn't because I started to cry and I started to grieve and I started to take responsibility for what I did. How could I have done this? You know, the horror of it, all of it, I started to feel it, and I went through waves of emotion. I mean, I was crying for weeks, you know. It was like grieving, you know. You cry and cry and cry, and you think, okay, I'm all right. And then it comes back, and then it comes back. But I finally, eventually, sat down to write this letter. And I don't know how, because I was crying again, and It was heavy. But I wrote this letter, and a week or two later, he said, I want you to read it with some recovering addicts. And again, there goes my soul, like, oh my God. And I don't know how I was going to do it, but I agreed. And I know it was my higher power, you know, and it was a guiding force, and I choose to call God, you know. In my language, we say, Fishakigomeche, which means the breath maker. You know, and some people say God, some people say Buddha, Krishna, Christ, whatever it is, you know, I love Narcotics Anonymous because Narcotics Anonymous gives us the freedom to choose a God of our understanding, whatever works for you. And if you work the program long enough, you're open-minded to everybody's God, to anybody's God. I'm not limiting myself. You believe in this? Okay, I believe that too, you know? I believe this, and I'm going to be open-minded. And so I read the letter, and the first line of the letter said, Janice, I know how you and I crossed paths that night. And again, you know, this is me writing it, but it's as if Charles is writing it to me, right? And in the moment I read that letter, that line, I should say, I felt like, because even as a child, I believed in life after death, because my people, you know, my father's family practiced the native traditions of the Seminoles, and my mother was raised by a Baptist father. So, come on, man. That's why I'm open, you know. So I always believed in something. I believed in a creator, I believed in a God, and I always believed in life after death because it was very important for us to bury our dead facing the sunset, you know, facing west, because they're going to walk into the sunset and travel to the next life, is what we believe. So when I read that line, Janice, I know how you and I crossed paths that night, I chose to believe that Charles is somewhere. His spirit lives. I killed his body, but I can't kill his soul. He exists somewhere. And because he exists in the presence of the Creator, to the source which I believe from which we all come, one source, as Bob Marley would say, one love. I believe that there is one source, and this source is so loving that my mortal, mere human mind can't even conceive the vastness of this love. And if Charles is with this love, he can forgive me. When I read, I knew how you and I crossed paths that night. Instantly, I knew he could see my father. He could see us crying, begging him to stop beating my mom. He could see people putting their hands on me when I was just a child. He knew, and he said, I know how. You know, like when we talk about, Vito has like 60 years clean. Come on, man, it's crazy, right? He didn't get there in one hour, not in 20 years. It took every day. And I didn't get to that store at 15 years old in one day. It was a process. And I knew Charles understood that. And I felt in that moment the spiritual principle of compassion. He could actually understand. The second line said, and I'm not mad at you. And in that moment, you know, whenever I've been mad at someone and I get to that point, I'm not mad at you. I forgive you. I'm okay. We're okay. And in that moment I read that, I know he could forgive me. Why? Because he's returned to a source that's so much greater and so much more loving and so much more spiritual than me. But he could understand and forgive me. And just like I said, the beliefs of my native people, you know, the last line said, and I'm not dead, I'm just not here. So, you know, it's not like the skies opened up and the angels came out and I was fine all of a sudden, you know. I was actually hurt so much because I still felt the responsibility for what I did. You know, I was taking, you know, I had to take responsibility, and that didn't feel good. And the man who had told me to write the letter said, listen, what you did was wrong. You know, and it's like when he said that, like he punched me in the chest. And he said, but from here, what you can do, what you gotta do is turn a negative into a positive. You have to live your life in service. You have to live your life helping other people. And that's how you make, you know, turn a negative into a positive, and you can do this in NA. And again, it didn't happen all at once. It was a process. I had severe post-traumatic stress disorder episodes for a few years. Because even like I saw roadkill on the road, it would just send me into like waves and waves of crying again and horror of it and feeling bad. And, you know, one of the things they told me here is pick up the phone, call people. A problem shared is a problem lessened. And I would call people and I'd say, I can't. And they'd say, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. You just stay clean. Keep going to meetings, call you, all the things they say, not rocket science, right? And I did it. And over the years, you know, little by little, especially when this happened, I had like a year or two clean, and I was asked to speak at another tribal facility. It was a rehab at another tribe's reservation, and they asked me to come out and share. And I was driving out there, it's a real long, lonely road, and it was dark as hell. But there was a million stars in the sky, millions, because it was so dark and it was so beautiful. And I'm driving, and I looked up and I said, Charles, you're up there. You're somewhere. You're Charles. I said, I'm going, because I was nervous. I've never shared and stuff, you know, but I was willing. And I looked up and I said, you know what, Charles, if you would, come with me. Help me share a message of hope. And ever since that night, I've done it every time I've been asked to share. You know, me and Charles are like this, you know. Let's do this thing. You know, it's my guilt, right? My guilt is gone, my shame, my regret, the remorse, the horror, all of it. It was transformed into gratitude, into service, into love for this fellowship. You know, Lorraine is right. There is nothing I won't do, you know, because I could do it the rest of my life and 10 lives more. It wouldn't be enough to repay what NA has done for me in my life. You know, and part of that is being at peace, feeling free. Speaking of free, I have a story for you. It had to be before COVID, maybe 2018. I've been on parole my whole life, practically, right? I mean, in the system since I'm 17, I'm either on parole or locked up or on parole. And wrong time, because, you know, I'm 66, so, well, almost. And so I'm just cruising along on this parole because I said, first of all, I violated twice. I'm convicted, you know, murderer. I had a life sentence. They're not going to parole me like in 5 years. You know, they're not going to release me from parole in 5 years. As I bided my time out, 15 years in, this is after I'm in NA and everything, you know, and doing service and have a lot of friends and a life and jobs and businesses. And, you know, I'm doing good. I always like to mention my Escalade Platinum Sport, you know. I'm doing good. And I got this parole officer who rode me, you know. I had all these officers that respected me. They knew what I did in the community. They know about my NA life. They respected me, but this last one I got was really something. And she compelled me to ask for a termination of my parole. I had a hearing coming up. I got all my friends in NA. I got all my family. I chartered 2 Learjets, and we flew to Tallahassee, baby. And we filled that conference room, and the panel was up here, 3 panel. And they said, and they asked me questions. A couple of my friends got up to share, you know, to give me a reference. And then they started to ask me questions. And I was able to share with them the story of Charles and the letter. And there was people in there for other hearings. And if you've never felt the presence of the Spirit, I can tell you that it exists. In that room, everybody was mesmerized. There was a power in that room. There was an energy. And the parole commission said, well, why did your parole officer recommend no change? You know, I wanted to say, because she's a, you know. I said, because she doesn't know me. We've only been together a short time. And, you know, they kind of huddled up and everything. And then they said, we've decided to go against. And we all dropped. We thought we were going to say go against, you know, this termination. They said, we've decided to go against the recommendation and we're granting you termination of your life parole. Yeah, Vito and Lorraine were there, so they can, you know, they'll let you know I'm not lying to you. And it was probably, I mean, really one of the greatest days of my life. You know, the other one was getting out after those 16 years and hugging my mom on the lawn of the prison. You know, I lost my mom 7 years ago this week. And but I had the opportunity to be clean for some years before she passed and to give back to her what she saw. I was locked up 23 years. My mom never missed a Thanksgiving or a Christmas in that prison. We ate, you know, sandwiches out of a machine and chips and a soda for 23 years. Wow. You know, she was my backbone. And when she passed, I'm sharing this because no matter what happens in life, and I really, you know, y'all know about the No Matter What Club, right? No matter what. No matter what happens, I don't have to use.
That's right.
I don't have to use. And as long as I don't use, I have a chance for another hour, another day, you know, another day in order to live this life in honor of Charles, you know, to honor him. You know, because what it came down to is simple. In the serenity prayer, it says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. You know, I don't care how much dope I shot, how much I drank, how much time I did, how much anything, it wasn't going to bring him back, you know. And grant me serenity, accept the things I cannot change. the courage to change the things I can, and the courage was I have to change me. You know, I had to write that fourth step. I had to work that sixth and seventh step, you know, and the eighth and all of it. All of it. And by the grace of God, by the time I got the 11th step, I embraced it so much. Because this is what I want. This is what I want. I want to be connected to my source. I want to always feel that I'm safe, that I'm loved, that I'm, you know, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The wisdom to know the difference is right here in this room. The 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the service, the love. You know, we got it. We got it. We just didn't learn how to practice it so well. You know, early on in my life, you know, I got derailed by things. And it created feelings in me I didn't want to feel. And drugs helped me not to feel these things. Shame. I was ashamed for something I didn't need to be ashamed about. It wasn't my fault. You know, so I really, like Lorraine said, I love NA, you know. I don't just do it because it keeps me free. I love NA. Don't get me wrong, I love the freedom. And but this is my purpose in life, you know, to give back what was so freely given to me. I have a primary purpose now, and I embrace it. I love the 11th step because it keeps me like I want to, at 20 and 19 years clean, I feel like I'm at the tip of the iceberg. I don't want to act like I know so much, because I really don't. I could, you know, I'm like anybody else. I could walk out of here to make one or two little choices, and I could be high. You know, I could be dead. I don't take anything for granted. I don't want to be dead. I want to do service. I want to show love. Of course, I thought I was going to get through this without losing my train of thought. But it's hard at 66. I had a little runny nose from my allergies. I was up in my room. I got 4 tissues, and I folded them together, and I got them ready to put in my pocket. They're upstairs in my room right now. And my nose is about to. But, yeah. The 11th and the 12th step, you know, it brings us to a purpose, and it brings us to a place that, for me, regenerates energy. If I stay in those steps, if I practice these principles in all my affairs, nothing gets stale. It regenerates. I'm really happy to be here. You know, it's cold. You know, in Florida at 70, we got our coats out, you know. It's cold, but it's refreshing. The people are, you guys are so friendly and welcoming and huggy. And not that they don't hug in Florida, but, you know, it's a different kind of thing. A little different. So I'm very grateful. You know, I really hope that there isn't something that I didn't share, and I'll sit up all night and say, dang, I forgot. We all do that, right? But I will tell you this. If you're new, it's a journey. It's not easy. It's simple. I tried to get stupid. I tried to be where I don't know everything. I listened to other people, and I did what they did. They said, if you want what we have, do what we do. You know, and that's what I did. I didn't try to complicate it too much, and I've been here 20 years. I had, in my first meeting, I had the coffee commitment for 3 years. I was a GSR for like 10 years. I'm a secretary now at my home group, no reservations. And I do service on every front I can. And just real quick, I'll finish with this. When I stepped into prison at 17 in 1974, another lady stepped in with me the same time. She was like 23, 24. She had I had a regular life sentence, a parolable life sentence. She got a mandatory life sentence, was 25 years mandatory, and then maybe they would parole her. Her and her husband got in a shootout with the cops during a robbery. And the cops shot a bystander, and they were charged with the murder. So she came in with the mandatory life sentence. Me and her ran wild. We, you know, we smuggled in weed. We made hooch. We stole everything that wasn't nailed down out of the kitchen. You know, we were running partners. And couple of years in, her husband escaped from the prison he was in and came and broke her out, and they escaped. And we're all like, yeah, you know. But unfortunately, they got caught. So she got 15 years consecutive to her mandatory life sentence. And she has to get paroled on the life sentence before she even starts on the 15. She's never been paroled on the life sentence. And this is, what, 40-something years later? More, maybe? And she's still there. My other running partner from the 90s, because I was locked up 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, lived my whole life, half my life. So my other running partner in the 90s was raised up in the system, group homes, you know, they call it DCF at home, I don't know. She was put in the, you know, system at an early age. Her mom was a drug addict. And her prosecutor at her trial, he said, this was a girl who was not going to end up at the high school prom. And she didn't. She was going to, you know, juvenile detentions at a young age, prison at a young age. And the last time she got out, she got on probation for some dumb stuff, and the judge said, I don't want to see your face again. But what did she do? She went out and did 5 home invasions. She shot 2 of the guys during a robbery, and then shot another man during another robbery. None of them died, but she came before the same judge, and he gave her 5 life sentences, because robbery carries life. Those two ladies, women, are never going to get out. And they didn't kill anybody. I took someone's life and I got out 3 times. Is it because I'm so special? It's because God wanted me to be here tonight to share a message of hope. And I'm very honored, very honored to be here. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.